Hello everyone and welcome to Coffee Science Guru. As always, I am Josh. I am the coffee portion of this wonderful podcast that is definitely your favorite and you love it. With me today, as always again, is Adam Carr, Dr. Adam Carr.
That's right. Science guy.
The science guy, the science
coffee
part.
Science, yep.
And last but not least, certainly, is our guru, our expert, Mr.
Otherwise
Julian.
Otherwise known as old-timer.
Old-timer.
Look, that's what I call you whenever I come in.
You can't teach experience. That's what I've always said.
No, I guess not.
Probably.
I don't know. Haven't read the studies. It's not my field of expertise.
Experience.
That's right.
Cool. Today we are doing a definitely more science-focused topic.
Hooray.
If any of you follow our editorial on our website or have checked our Facebook page recently over the last week, you'll see that Adam has been a part of a very cool study with the University of New South Wales, focusing on water in and around coffee, which in the industry has been quite interesting and sort of much spoken about topic, being that 90% plus of any coffee you drink is going to be water and only a small amount is actually coffee. So, of course, it's easy to assume that water is going to make a big difference. It also can affect your equipment and stuff like that. So, Adam, what did you and the very intelligent people at UNSW do?
Well, I like to think we're all pretty intelligent. We set up a project. So it was kind of a 7 miles initiative. We set up a project with the University of New South Wales, just basically to understand precisely what it was that changes in water quality did to espresso. So I think that wasn't just a matter of getting different waters, throwing them through coffee, and then, you know, tasting the coffee, although that certainly was a part of it at one stage. It was actually looking at the quantifiable chemistry. That is, you know, changes in calcium content inside the water quality. How'd that change the extract known as 2-furfurothiol, or I think in this case it was furaneol, which is called strawberry. I think it's strawberry furan. Basically, the strawberry berry kind of flavor that you would experience in a coffee is, you know, typically ascribed to furaneol. So we looked at analyzing the quantity of that material inside a coffee, and we did that a few different ways. But we got the numbers for it. So numbers relating to numbers, getting trends and graphs, and actually, you know, we're quantifying it. Not just getting a basic understanding behind it, but, like, you know, doing the science.
Yeah, right.
Doing the science right.
Yeah, because water by itself is sort of a bit of an outlier in the chemistry world, in the physical world, would you say?
Yeah, it's quite non-ideal. I mean, that's right.
The universal solvent.
Universal solvent, it's an interesting one. Like, you know, you think about water even at the high temperature. So we extract coffee at, what, between 90 and 100 degrees Celsius typically. I know there's...
In general.
Yeah, in general around that. But, you know, it's interesting. When you take water to 100 degrees Celsius, its polarity changes so that it's actually more in line with acetonitrile or methanol. It's got more alike to that than it does water at room temperature.
Right.
As a solvent, at least.
Yeah.
Although it's not quite. It's got a lot of other things wrong with... Not wrong. Sorry. Nothing wrong with water. It's a fantastic molecule.
Well, weird. I mean, they've always said in relation to coffee, particularly, you know, to boil is to spoil. It's certainly true that if you put coffee into a saucepan and bring it nearly to the boil and pour it into a cup, something tastes very nice, probably.
Yeah, right.
Bring it to the boil and allow it to bubble for a few seconds, and it undergoes a dramatic chemical change and a dramatic flavour change, which is generally thought to be unacceptable.
Yeah, how interesting. What's the kind of flavour characteristics of boiling coffee, or have you never made a boiled coffee in your life?
Well, it's bitterness.
It's bitter, so it's kind of over-extracted in the bitter.
So I think it immediately encourages all those undesirable elements of coffee which are present because it is a bitter substance.
Yeah.
To be very, very quickly extracted
and
beyond redemption.
Very interesting. Yeah, I wonder why that is. We didn't actually boil water, actually. We put boiling water through it. It'd be kind of interesting to see what happens to coffee, like if there's some kind of reaction with steam or something behind it.
Yeah.
We're talking about what we didn't do, I suppose, now, but at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, there's always more to do, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's interesting, the balance. I mean, even the Rancilio RS1 recently, they're playing around with temperature profiling, which is not something we're going to get into here. But, you know,
that's for a future.
That's for a future podcast, I'm sure.
If they're listening.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the Rancilio, of course, used to have an evil reputation of being the hottest coffee machine of, of the thousand different brands and so on.
Interesting. So how ironic. That one's focusing on temperature profile.
I mean, they've been around for a silly amount of time, right? Like the, so that would have, the old lever machines, the old Rancilio levers, they would have been quite
hot.
Toasty, quite warm.
Wouldn't want to put the inside of your arm against any of those parts.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah, in the studies, you know, we didn't actually vary temperature all that much. I think we, for our experiments, we put all of it through, so we used a standard coffee, I think it was Bellarama Octavia, a medium roast blend of about four different coffees.
Yeah.
Five. That's right, five.
Yeah.
We put it through a Lamazoco Linea Mini.
Mm-hmm. And the Linea Mini kept up very well.
Apart from when we used pH 14 water, that was...
No, it was 11.4.
Oh, it was 11.4?
Yeah.
Still pretty high.
Yeah.
I mean, 11.4 is not something you're normally going to get in a regular water supply.
Yeah, it definitely...
Unless you spiked it with sodium
hydroxide.
It
turns the espresso into jelly.
Yeah.
And it, like... It was like coffee ceviche.
Mm.
So like the ground coffee went into the basket brown, and after it brewed for, I think, we got like 10 grams out in like 2 minutes.
Yeah, right.
And it was jelly. And then when we took the handle out, the coffee was black.
Yeah, how interesting.
And smelt burnt and smelt like acrid. Burnt.
So it's actually cooked. Been reacting. Well, it's an interesting one because you actually think what's happening inside there. Coffee, by and large, is a relatively acidic organic material. When you add high pH water, you're adding an alkaline material. So we actually get a neutralization reaction occurring, which typically liberates heat, generates gas, and can actually facilitate oxidation of coffee. So you actually are in some ways roasting with a different chemical reaction.
Yeah, right. So you were talking here basically about huge over-extraction.
I don't know. I didn't see the... I haven't seen the results for the chemicals of that one.
The chemicals were
standard.
Much higher in concentration. Though, interestingly enough, based on that, I'd actually come to think of it, I'm actually wondering if we did the GC analysis of that. So, by the way, to do the analysis of the chemistry, we used a technology called gas chromatography and mass spectrometry. So, basically, it's mass spectrometry identifies the molecule that we're looking at analyzing. The GC, the gas chromatography device, through a column, basically separates individual molecules out from each other. And then with the signal generated by the mass spectrometer, you can actually quantify the amount of material that's there. So I don't think use the GCMS for the super high pH. Either way, we found there was a pretty linear trend with pH with respect to extract concentration. So the higher the pH you got from, you know, going from 6.5 right through to 11, you get a linear increase in extraction in terms of concentration. That was of all flavors, I think, except... I should double check like this. I'm pretty sure it was everything except caffeine.
Right.
Yeah. So there was one or two. There was vanillin and there's caffeine and exhibited two non-conformational. It didn't conform to the trends identified for the rest of the molecules and two different things. One was with pH and one was with hardness.
Because it just dissolved regardless.
One didn't change its concentration at all. Actually, it remained constant throughout the entire time. And I probably should actually reference the blog. It's all there on the blog, on the 7 Miles editorial. Let me just have a quick look at that. Probably should remember that off the top of my head. I only wrote the blog last week.
But I'm sure plenty of stuff.
We had hundreds of results in there. I'm trying to remember that one.
It's probably what? 1,500 words?
I think it was 2,500 before we edited it down. But that's right. We're going to come out with a lengthier report on this in the future. I'm also doing two presentations in SCA about this as well.
So. Yeah, so if you're in Boston, we have a few listeners in America for the SCA conference in Boston.
Yeah.
Adam will be there talking about coffee and water, which would be cool. So I know for a lot of baristas out there, designing quote-unquote your own water for coffee is becoming a bit more popular. Getting distilled water and just adding, typically it's sodium bicarbonate.
Yeah.
Or calcium bicarbonate.
They're changing the alkalinity.
And magnesium salts.
Magnesium sulfates, a few other things like that.
Yeah, so I mean...
Non-chloride containing salts.
That's essentially all they're adding to what should be just pure water.
Mm.
But with water from the tap, it's a bit more complicated than just those two things, especially when brewing coffee, right?
Well, it's a funny one, you know, with water and, you know, One of the big things we found initially, and I'm sure this is well known in the people who actually manipulate water on a daily basis, you don't just do one thing to coffee and everything else remains the same. Water. You don't just add a bit of calcium salt and all of a sudden you just change the calcium content. Mm. You change the TDS level, which makes some sense. That's total dissolved solids. You also change the pH value.
Yeah.
So what actually is affecting so when people are tasting coffees at the end of the day, is it because of the calcium salt you added, or is it because you've changed the pH? You can't separate the two. So yep. One of the challenges we had in this was trying to find a way of being able to manipulate calcium content without manipulating pH, TDS, or any of the other variables inside there.
Yeah, so for those of us who don't know...
Which we nearly achieved.
TDS is short for total dissolved solids, and it just means the percentage of physical matter dissolved in a substance. So like sugar in water,
yep.
Or coffee in water,
yeah.
Or...
So we had a look at the TDS. So it's one of those ones. If you're looking at TDS alone, we found that TDS, if you changed only TDS, you didn't change the hardness, you didn't change the pH, that we could do. We changed that with sodium chloride. That was the easiest thing to do, manipulate the TDS without changing the other two things. We found that there was zero effect on the solubility of any of those materials. So the extraction concentration of furanil, of the chocolate malt flavors, of a whole bunch of other flavors in there, didn't change whatsoever.
Yeah.
And that was over a factor of 10 change in the TDS that we put in there, well above what you typically find in water content. So TDS made no difference. So that's one of those things we put in our blog, let's stop talking about TDS. It's a very average form of measurement. Unless you're trying to remove everything inside your water, reverse osmosis filtration, to try and get pure water with nothing else in it. TDS makes sense then because you're aiming for a TDS of zero.
Yeah.
But outside of that, that's not the thing to look at.
Yeah.
It's a unit of measure, but it's not...
Trying to make your water more hard to get a higher extraction.
That would make some sense.
Or a more efficient extraction. Yeah.
So when it came to hardness, if I'm just looking at the blog now, we found that the nutty chocolate flavors, the fruity flavors, the vanilla caramel flavors... all increased quite significantly. Caffeine was the only thing that didn't change with hardness. In fact, if anything, it went down. However, if you look at that's what the data would tell you, but if you look at the variability in the data, it basically stayed flat across the entire time. There's a slight trend downwards, but caffeine remained relatively constant, which is kind of interesting.
So what's the difference between hardness and TDS?
So hardness is just a measure effectively of the calcium and magnesium, so the multivalent cations inside your water. So that's...
Is that the pH you're talking about then?
No, this is... hardness. Hardness has to do with calcium and magnesium typically.
Yeah.
That
relates somewhere along the line to the pH of the,
It does a bit in the sense of what the calcium's bonded to. The form of calcium will have an effect on the pH.
Hmm.
So
I'm trying as a layman to understand this.
Sure.
My own experience of, particularly of coffee life in England back in the in the 60s and 70s and so on, where water quality was a great factor, in the sense that depending upon where you were in England or Scotland, you either had very soft water or you had very hard water or you had water that was full of chalk. And they, of course, had dramatic effects upon boilers and pressurized vessels
scaling,
and things
all
like
those
that.
Things. Yep.
In those days, certainly not coffee, but certainly tea, and one has to perhaps draw some kind of analogy there.
Yeah, for sure.
Tea was blended specifically in parts of England and Scotland according to the hardness or softness of the water.
Hmm.
London was noted as a hard water area. And a company called Brooke Bond, as part of Unilever and so on, still around, had a very, very big franchise for their particular tea in London and surrounding areas. If you went to Birmingham, the water was very soft. And a company called Typhoo had the franchise there, and ditto in Scotland. So depending upon where you were in England or Scotland, so you had companies who had 20% of the market total of the whole of the UK concentrated in quite small areas, which they guarded really in a sense, not because they had to do anything, but simply because they had the right tea and the right water in that one place.
Yeah.
Do they make a note of what the flavour was like in their regions of hard or soft?
I don't know about that, but it certainly didn't apply to coffee. No one was blending coffee specifically for water.
Yeah.
Perhaps there should have been.
I've wondered if the trends in different states, at least in Australia, of types of coffee that is more drunk, like sort of longer extractions, lighter roasts in Melbourne.
Maybe for harder water.
Yeah.
Or that can make some sense.
More filter coffee.
Yeah, right. Because
rather than Sydney.
Yeah, because like the darker roast you have, typically the higher the content of solubles you get inside your coffee, right? Yes. So the harder the water, or the softer the water, the lower the content would be. So if you have very soft water, a dark roasted coffee may make more sense.
Yeah.
Well, there may well be a call for coffees to be blended for certain degrees of hardness, but of course also degrees of quality of water.
Yeah.
So you take Melbourne, which is noted to have really very good clean water because it has sealed off dams, which nobody desired to enter. And no runoff and pollution going into them and so on. So Melbourne water is noted to be very good. Sydney water is okay. It's generally soft, but of course there are parts of the Sydney catchment system which are far from immune from runoff and things like that.
Yeah, we get a whole bunch of different results. It's interesting, actually. So one of the interesting findings from this study also is that we found that Sydney water's treatment targets are almost ideal for coffee. Mm. So the water that is typically coming out of that plant, I think the Ryde plant and a few of the other plants, they aim for between, I think, 50 and 70 ppm hardness. And we found that the range of 50 to 80 ppm hardness is ideal for extraction of flavors. If we're just treating hardness by itself, pH we treat separately here. You can't necessarily, right? Because conventionally, the harder the water, normally the higher the pH as well, right?
I'm rather more coming from the point of view of the quality of the water and what is actually in it.
Yeah, well, that's it.
Shouldn't be there.
Well, water quality. Well, that's actually one of the reasons we have got a relatively high chloride content in water, right? Because we add chloride or chlorine. Yeah. Water to remove a lot of the nasties, the bugs, which is a part of TDS, by the way. You know, your bugs inside there and the biological materials produced by them and other such things.
Your guardia and the cryptosporium.
Yeah, well, exactly. There's a reason it's there. The reason it's there is to try and kill those nasties that would make you sick and also make your water taste rather foul.
Yeah. Well, there certainly was a time when Adelaide water was considered to be undrinkable up until about 2000, and then they embarked on a long program, which they're still involved with, whereby the water quality has improved so dramatically that it's now probably on a par with other states.
Well, it's funny that you say all these things, because this is one of the reasons that I was a bit skeptical coming into the water quality thing. I feel like there are a lot of very able engineers, scientists and people out there that day in, day out are trying to get the best quality water for drinking. You know, these are guys who actually know how to manipulate water to try and get the targets thereafter. As I said, they're not just dosing some salts in there to try and make it taste a little bit better. They're actually trying to work on that massive chemical balance to get it just right so it's healthy and actually tastes good. So I think that's the skepticism. It's like, you know, we're just starting off by adding some salts, let's strip it out. You know, that's not a bad thing to do, actually, stripping your water down to nothing and then adding little bits here and there. You know, that's not a bad way of doing it.
Aim for flavor.
Right, exactly. You know, you want to see what the effect of every individual thing is on flavor. I respect that, but it also needs to be done right, and, you know, take into appreciation everything done with water. That's why we did it, and that's why we teamed up with the university, you know.
Yeah.
The Center of Membrane Science, the UNESCO Center of Excellence for Membrane Science. You know, we partnered with them.
I certainly conclude from my reading on the subject of water quality in South Australia, that because 85% plus actually comes out of the Darling River, into which all sorts of stuff is daily pouring, mostly undesirable, that their treatment and the strides they have made in making their water palatable is, of course, in accordance with huge amounts of intervention before it actually reaches the consumer.
More so than
in any other state.
Yeah, it's an interesting one that they're going to be constantly monitoring that, because that'll change on a daily, yearly, year in, year out basis, right? They're going to be constantly changing.
Sometimes it rains.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. So if the water quality is fluctuating at your cafe, you know, it could be for a whole bunch of different reasons.
Infrastructure as well. So whether you're getting the perfect water for coffee, what kind of pipes is it running through? How old are they? What are they made out of?
Exactly.
Has there been civil works in the area? Have they changed some pipes out for others and some dirt's washed through?
That's why we always, you know, I would always activate. I would always recommend you use an activated carbon pre-filter or filter anywhere you go, because that kind of thing's going to try and strip a whole lot of those solids.
What effect would that have upon lots of lovely lead, for instance?
It should capture that.
Should it?
It should capture it. I mean, it should capture a whole lot of heavy metals. That's almost primarily what it's designed to do. It's an adsorbent. It's a sponge. Right. It's designed to capture a whole lot of those materials in there. It actually captures some chloride as well. In our tests, we found that at the low levels that Sydney water has of chloride, or the relatively low levels, it generally captures about between 50 and 90% of it, of the chloride. That was only at a small level, though. I don't know if that was, like, it's got an efficiency, separation efficiency of 50 to 90%, or if that's just the low levels that captured that much of that. You know, is it an absolute number, or is it a relative number?
When it's got a heavy dose in it following that large rains or something like that, then that probably wouldn't apply in the same way.
Agreed. Yeah, well, exactly. So, yeah. I mean, that's one of the things also. We didn't actually publish a whole bunch of intervention that you can do to achieve that. We do actually know what that is. We did do a second project with the university looking at that, although we are, we haven't published that for a number of reasons. We have a heuristic that we can use at 7 miles now to go in there and try and achieve the target water that we're after. But it's one of those things. It's not so simple. I think one of the points is it's not a simple thing to do. You really need to get in there, do some measurements, check it out, and then go through this problem-solving, pathway to eventually get to that water quality that you're after. The nice thing is the technology exists to manipulate water nowadays, even under a bench. So, we strive to do that kind of thing here as well.
Yeah, and like reverse osmosis equipment's getting, it wasn't that long ago when it was extremely wasteful, like a 1 to 3. So every liter of water that would get RO'd, 3 would go in, down the drain.
Yeah.
Where now it's closer to a 1 to 1, or it is a 1 to 1.
Yeah.
And it's a lot more affordable. So places that are regional or have issues with consistency and stuff can sort of look towards that without breaking the bank.
Yeah, it's a funny one. I mean, that's another one of the reasons we did the project is there are a few ROs, reverse osmosis. Yeah. We were starting to install a whole lot of those and determining whether or not that was overkill. Especially learning that Sydney water targets are actually perfect for coffee. Are we actually over-filtering our water? Are we trying to strip all the good stuff out of it and then trying to dose a little bit more? That's not a sustainable solution.
Yeah,
an expensive solution.
Getting
as well.
The same water in and out, essentially.
Yeah, well, exactly. You're stripping it down to put the same thing in it that were already in it.
I having worked on the road and testing water with our little kits from one building across the road from another, you get different readings.
Yeah.
And then, older parts of the city, like the rocks, you get a lot higher hardness and things
and
like that.
Yeah.
So
and that's why we always, our results are sprinkled with, seasoned with a bit of salt.
There's
so
always
so this
little asterisk.
Yeah, there's
disclaimer.
An asterisk. Like,
Your mileage may vary.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when we went out there, we went with a more sophisticated tool to measure water quality. Yeah. So we also used a technology.
Very much.
The HANA multiprobe, which is a lot more accurate than the iDIPS that we use.
Yeah, it looks like something Snake Plissken had used to take down a bunch of people in New York.
It was a bit of a weapon. Deep cut. But then we also did the metal content analysis back at the university through what's called inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry. Similar to GCMS, but completely different. it was basically there to quantify all the, sodium, magnesium, calcium, everything in water. You quantified it.
Now, you got, scientific analysis on the one hand
yes.
and actual taste perceptions on the other.
Mm.
Have we done any work with comparisons, particularly in terms of taste, where you brew coffee using 5 grams, 7 grams, 10 grams, 12 grams to see what effect that has upon the palate?
Yeah,
because one would imagine that the more coffee there was in the group handle or in a pot or something like that, the less the actual underlying quality of the water would be so important.
So we've done the actual taste thresholds. That's an interesting one, Julian. So the short answer is yes, we've done some of the taste tests around it. The issue with doing taste tests and then getting reliable data is that everyone's taste is different.
Yes.
And so that's why we did the chemical analysis. So for an ale at a certain threshold, we know we can taste it. We just measured its variability across the entire time. Across all the changes in water concentration. So that's where the quantification in some ways, what's the word, removing the subjectivity from it, so to speak. However, we all know at the end of the day, subjectivity reigns supreme in terms of who's going to buy a coffee and what makes a good coffee. It's something that we need to be doing a bit more of. And we do, we do have a sensory masterclass course at 7 Miles. We go through varying the water quality.
Yes, we do.
And taste the differences it makes. So I think Matt even just did the other day, and I went through with him. He just dosed some calcium salt in some reverse osmosis treated water, and the difference was tangible.
Yes. Well, it's certainly my experience in terms of adding milk to things that once you get below a certain gram percentage of coffee extracted, you can hardly taste coffee at all. With your eyes closed, it might well be a cup of tea.
Yeah, right.
Of course, we have moved beyond that because we actually want consumers to be able to identify the difference between coffee and tea and indeed enjoy it in the process.
Even the fat content in your milk can change how you taste as well.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, well, then that's the other thing. Again, going up back to the Rancho again, but looking at the temperature profile, you set your machine to 89 and you set machine to 92. You have two completely different flavor profiles there as well. So it's all, you know, there are so many things that can change in coffee that change the flavor of the coffee. So I think, you know, for us, isolating those things just to purely water quality, which again is not an isolated effect.
On top of origin and processing and
brew
method and temperature, time,
or
weight.
Oils in coffee.
The things that dissolve in coffee, the things already in your water, the things that are dissolved during the... So actually, here's another one of those interesting things that we found from our results, moving back to the study again. Sorry, not that I want to... Well, I shouldn't say I don't want to keep dwelling on it. That is the topic of today's podcast.
It is true, yeah.
Was that we actually found vanillin. So I was talking earlier, what was the compound that didn't do the right thing like everyone else did? It was vanillin. Vanillin, which is also described as a caramel or malt type flavor in coffee. I'm sure everyone's rather familiar with vanilla. It had a strange effect. So where everything else increased with pH, vanillin decreased.
Right.
Until it got to a pH of 7.7, and then it increased again. So at pH 11.6, which is where it barely stopped, it had a higher extraction concentration than it did at the acidic pH. So it had a local minimum, some would call that, in terms of trends. It minimized around 7.7 and increased again. Now, I'm not sure, I try to offer an explanation, but when something like that happens, it's very hard to explain. Because we didn't do the, you know, the solubility of pure vanillin, right? We didn't look at the varying calcium concentration and, you know, see where vanilla stopped dissolving, then measure it. We did it as a function of the entire coffee brew, right? So it can happen that because you're extracting, you know, hundreds of compounds at the same time, the concentration of other compounds can help dissolve other compounds. So for example, if I wanted to extract more of a certain kind of compound, I could dose methanol into my water and I know I'd extract more caffeine, for example. I don't know that, by the way. I'm just saying, like, for example, you add a different solvent in a different concentration, you would expect the polarity changes, and then the whole nature of the solvent changes, which means that some things will dissolve more, some things less. It could have been that some other material that was being extracted at the same time as vanillin helped extract more vanillin at a certain pH. So that's a relatively complicated explanation.
So maybe it wasn't the pH directly, but maybe it was the pH
presence of other materials
affecting
inside.
Which affected the vanillin.
This is why we, you know, chemical engineers do this. We do the bucket chemistry, right? We look at the inputs and look at the output changes. So we absolutely, you know that this is what happens, at least with this coffee and these kinds of waters that we tested, right? We know that this effect happened, but the precise why, you know, to do that kind of effect, you'd have to then isolate it. You look at vanillin by itself and see how, you know, it changed with one, two, three, four, five different things. And that's...
And then you'd have your eyedropper and you'd be putting a drop in there, two drops in there, three drops in there.
Yeah, and then when I say drops, I mean, you're using a little, you know, you're using the precise things there, right? I mean, that's actually what I did my PhD on, actually, solubility of pure substances in hot water. Well, that was one part of my PhD.
Crazy.
And that's the thing. Like, I know how to do those kinds of studies, and they're not simple.
No.
You know, this is the, by the way, if anyone wants to do a PhD in coffee, please look at vanilla. And the effect of water conditions and ions and various co-solvents on the solubility of vanilla in hot water, please. Thank you very much.
Yeah. That would be, we'll help you out.
I can help you out. Yes, we can help you out. CSEC can help you. 7 Miles can help you. We have some data.
we can start you off.
That's right.
Alrighty.
Yeah.
So, I guess, What do we do now, I guess, is always the question. So we have an idea about where coffee, or what affects coffee extraction. Do you see this sort of, do you see people kind of taking to water and doing different, like if they have a Brazilian coffee and they want to extract something different, so they play with the pH or something like that, like, or is this test kind of proven that coffee behaves a little better in certain parameters?
So I think what the results of this test I think are that we have a good idea of the brew window. So a lot of work was done on the SCA about quantifying what the ideal brew range was in coffee.
Yeah. especially
with respect to water quality.
Yeah.
I think we, and the interesting thing was they've done that about by based on a whole bunch of different work, but no actual experiments like this. From what I'm aware, based on recent comments and being seen in literature review, this is actually the first time this kind of data has been produced. Or if it has been produced, first time it's been published.
Yeah.
So the ranges that we quantified inside our experiments were that if you want to brew a good cup of coffee, we recommend you have a hardness range between 50 and 80 parts per million. We also recommend you have a pH range between 7 and 8.5. And that you don't worry about TDS. Those were sort of the three major findings in terms of if you want to try and get your water right to get the best cup of coffee you can possibly have, based on our results, we recommend those ranges. So that's how someone could use the results of this work at this point in time. In terms of specifically looking at Brazilian coffee origins, I don't think we could make any inference about that.
No.
Maybe some of the thing we mentioned earlier, looking at dark roast versus light roast.
Yeah.
If you're not that you'd want to be necessarily playing with your water a huge amount, I think that's one of the things. It's a complex business, and I think another thing that's coming out of this work, it's very, very complex to do it. If you find you maybe, okay, maybe if you have very, very soft water at home,
which
you use a darker roasted coffee.
In times gone by, soft water at home meant superior extraction or quicker extraction or more extraction as opposed to pH levels below the 7 and so on, where you would expect
so high pH versus the low pH
to take a long time, a longer time to extract and also finish up with a thinner tasting beverage.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I think for here, I think, you know,
and the same applied to tea.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, it makes some sense. And a lot of the flavonoids generated have a comparable chemical structure. I mean, looking at small aromatics, you know, multi-bond, you know, small chain compounds. Yeah.
Sometimes coffee tastes
polar
like tea.
And semi-polar. What's that?
Sometimes coffee tastes like tea.
Sometimes coffee does taste like tea. We have that the Colombian coffee that Josh Robertson used for his comp.
I don't think tea ever tastes like coffee.
No,
Well, it's a different process, right?
My experience, anyway.
Yeah. So I think, again, you know, summary of the outcomes, I think, you know, that main one is the brew window. I think, you know, softer coffee, soft water environments, maybe looking at a darker roasted coffee might make some sense. And the vice versa, if you've got very, very hard water, looking at like a lighter roasted coffee, it makes some sense based on the findings of this results. Again, like not a lot of people doing at home. If some people at home are listening, you know, do you get your pool test kit out and have a look at your water? I mean, that actually is not the worst idea.
For your fish tank.
Was that? Yeah, if you've got a fish tank at home.
The strips.
Yeah, use your strips and get a good idea, and then you can have an idea of what kind of coffee might best suit your water.
It might not be calibrated for something that's like that. Well, I mean, it should be, right? It's water.
The other thing to do is just buy a few bags of coffee of different roasts and taste it and see if you like it. I mean, I just say it, that's still not the worst way of going about getting your coffee.
Yeah. Well, that's true, but I mean, another rule of thumb was, you know, if you don't like the coffee that you just made, try doubling the quantity.
Yeah. It's good. It's worked well for the roasted.
I suppose what I'm really saying is a lot of people actually make both coffee and tea too weak. They don't put enough in.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. I think I've always put too much coffee in. Since coming back to look at the brew chart, I realise I've been putting way too much coffee in. I still like it that way.
Yeah, I mean,
well, you obviously enjoy it.
Yeah, I do. I like the mouthfeel of a very thick coffee. Yeah, well, that's it. That's the other thing, right? Who's to say you're right or wrong?
Yeah.
I think the other thing to say about these results is that these limits are partly done by machine protection as well. So I think that's another point to mention.
Your expensive gear.
Yeah, exactly. So the recommendation of a pH higher than 8.5, you will theoretically get more flavour out at higher pHs, but you start risking, you know, you get something too alkaline or too acidic, you might start attacking your boiler. Yeah. So you might be getting some corrosion happening inside there. Similar with hardness, right? Higher PPM hardness, you were saying, like, you know, certain, you know, cases of lime and, you know, scale developing inside your machine. I mean, that'll destroy a boiler pretty quick if you don't look after it, that is.
Yeah,
well, lime will destroy it and chalk will simply bugger up the elements if you have
it. Yeah, it won't get any coffee out.
Or it'll take 3 days to heat up instead of 30 minutes.
Yeah, that's right. That's happening to my kettle now. I need to deal with that.
Yes.
Yeah. So...
cool. Well, that's a quick water in a nutshell.
Oh, you want to read more? There's more on the blog.
Yeah, read the blog. Send us an email if you have more questions, because I feel like when we touch on topics like this, it kind of opens more questions than it answers.
That's the best thing about these things.
Which I think is probably the objective.
I think so. Well, that's a nice thing. I've got a few things even coming out of this conversation we could probably extend to the next the studies over the next year. Yeah. So
why?
Yeah, why? How? Why? Oh, that's right. We forgot about that.
Why?
Oh, yeah, we didn't touch on that.
Why?
When multiple brains come in and actually start thinking about something from multiple different perspectives, it's always good. Always leads to something.
Yeah. Cool. Well, yeah, send us an email. Check the editorial on 7miles.com. The email is podcast@7miles.com.au. Send us an email. Talk to us on social media. All the rest of it. You guys know how to do it. And thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Adam.
Thanks.
Thank you, Julian.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, cool. Our next, we should be recording and posting episodes a bit more frequently now. The beginning of the year has been years are always top heavy, right? Top heavy and then like
top and tail heavy.
Yeah. In the middle, you kind of chill because it's cold.
More time, you chill and more time for podcasts.
But yeah, we'll be a bit more consistent from now. So yeah, thanks everyone for listening. I'll see you later.
See you later. Bye.
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 Bye.